If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host. And today we have with us a guest, Captain Dan Brinson, retired wildlife officer from the state of Washington, formerly with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Police. And he's appearing with us from his home in Washington State. Dan, thanks for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Good to see you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. When I thought about doing this podcast years ago, I kind of put together in my head a list of people who I would want to have on, and you were on the short list, on the list. And I think listeners and watchers will understand why pretty quickly. Dan, I introduced you as a retired captain with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, but you had a long career with the state of Washington as a conservation law enforcement officer. And during that time, state of Washington went through some changes in growth in terms of how they organized their conservation law enforcement. And I want you to kind of explain that to everybody. But first, I want to know, you and I have never really talked about this before. We met probably in the mid late 90s, somewhere between 95 and 97, probably. But I have a recollection of how we met, but I'm not sure it's accurate. What's your recollection of how we met?
I'm trying to remember the first time we met. I don't know if you had just walked over from the AG's office where you were and came in and introduced yourself around. I must have happened to be there at the time. But what I remember is like, here's this attorney coming over wanting to be a game warden, you know? Yeah. I thought it was cool. It's like, oh, great. Finally there'll be somebody else smarter than me here. No, just kidding. We got along great. I think we did some ride-alongs, maybe on a boat even. I'm trying to remember. But you were fascinated by the idea of our work, and and you made a very good impression, and we became fast friends. And then you even became I think you were in the process of being a reserve officer, but also you put in to be an actual, you know, paid officer. And you were selected, you were ready to go to the academy, and then life happens, and you had some family, immediate family to take care of in Colorado, and off you went. And then next thing I know, you're a special agent.
Next thing you know, I'm Ed the Fed.
Yeah.
So, you know, okay, that's good, because that's pretty close to what I remember. You know, I think people who've listened to this podcast before kind of have gotten the gist, or maybe I've said it before. I became a special agent for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. I was a practicing lawyer. Right. And when I lived in Washington State, I was an assistant attorney general for the state of Washington. But from the moment I graduated from law school, I wanted to become a conservation law enforcement officer. So at that time, right after I graduated, I looked at fisheries patrol officer. And I don't think I ended up applying for that job because I wanted to be more, I think, wildlife. And then I also started applying to be a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agent. But even with this, as you know, even getting in with the state is not easy. And, and getting in with the feds is not easy either. And I was kind of naive about that. So when I graduated from law school, I thought, I'm a little cocky. I thought, I have a law degree, I'll get in. And I didn't. So I kept working as a lawyer as I was applying for these jobs. So I always say I accidentally practiced law. But anyway, back to the point of how we met. My office at the Attorney General's office, the window of my office actually overlooked the courtyard between the Attorney General's building in Olympia and the Department of Natural Resources building. And in the main floor of the DNR building was the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement Office. And it just so happened that in the DNR building was the cafeteria for both buildings.
Okay, there you go. And you like that food better?
Well, we didn't have one in the AG's office. We didn't have our own cafeteria. So if we wanted to eat at the cafeteria, we had to walk over to the DNR building across the courtyard. So what I think I did, I used to kind of stalk you guys. I would look for the uniformed officers eating lunch if they happened to be at headquarters. And I think I kind of like and just walked up to you and like invited myself to join you for lunch. I think
that does ring a bell.
I think you were with another officer, might have been Greg Haw. I'm not sure, but I think I just kind of invited myself. Here I was, you know, I wore a suit and tie every day, and
right,
I was so nervous you guys were going to think. I knew you'd be polite to me, but I thought you'd probably giggle about me after I left and say, you know, who's this idiot wants to think he can be a game warden, you know. But I stalked you, and you were very, very kind to me. And there are two people in my career, Dan, that I credit with getting me into wildlife law enforcement. And you're one of them. And you're the first one, really, because you're the first one that really took an interest in my interest and, you know, made it feel like it was something I could do. And it wasn't stupid. You know, when you're here, I was, most people go from law enforcement to practicing law. And here I was trying to do the opposite.
Right.
And, you know, I was self-conscious about it because my feeling was most people would look at me and be like, you're an idiot. What are you doing? You know, why are you doing this? And you didn't, you kind of instantly understood why I wanted to be in that role. And yeah, the first thing you did was you invited me to go out with you on, I think it was the opening day of the shrimp season.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was a really awesome introduction. I don't know if you planned it that way, because maybe, you know, being on a boat all day and pulling shrimp pots was something you were like, well, let's test this dude and see if he's really interested. I don't know.
Did I force you to eat a raw shrimp that day?
Yeah, of course you did. Yeah. That was part of the tradition, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. But then we did, you know, you invited me to go on a number of ride-alongs, which was really eye-opening for me. I got to ride with you and other officers and see what the work was like. We went on multiple boat patrols, I think. And then, I think you're at the time you were a sergeant and you were in charge of the reserve officer.
Yeah. The Marine Detachment, right? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You were the sergeant for the Marine Detachment there in Olympia. And, I started the process to get signed up as a reservist, but there was something weird going on with the department's program. It had lapsed and then it came back. So I think I was on paper, but I never went through the training or anything.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then actually, you helped me get hired as a wildlife officer for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I was all set to do that. And then, as you say, life happens, and I ended up going to Colorado for a few years before I became an agent. Anyway, long story. In my view, I owe my career in great part to Dan Brinson and the things you taught me. I mean, honestly, throughout my career, there were lessons that I learned from just doing ride-alongs with you or being on boat patrols or just shooting the shit with you.
Right.
There are lessons I learned that I carried with me my whole career that I utilized in doing my work.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's I'm honored to be that guy. If I really was that guy, I'm honored to be him. I'll wear that badge with pride.
You definitely were. And you know, everybody in their life needs a guy like that, right? Or a gal. You need somebody that kind of helps guide you on how do you do this, where do you go, what do you do next, right?
Yep.
So let's get to this. We've had guests on who have been with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So we had Todd Vandevert on early in this season.
I listened to that just the other day. I was trying to catch up on all your episodes.
Cool. Yeah. I had never met Todd before. He came on the show, but you know, very interesting work that he did. And then a number of agents who I knew at Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who were friends of mine and I worked with, had been former Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife officers. Steve Furr and Corky Roberts were both former. So can you explain really, so you mentioned you started as a fisheries patrol officer.
That is correct. Yeah. So prior to the merger of 94, or I think was around our merger, the state of Washington had two different agencies for conservation law enforcement. Had the Washington Department of Fisheries and then the Washington Department of Game. The Department of Game was had the Fish and Wild or the Game Commission at the time, and their policy was directed by the commission, like we are now again. The Department of Fisheries was different in the way that we work directly, as any agency would through the governor's office. And we had maybe 50 at the most commission personnel. The Department of Game was much larger because they covered every nook and cranny of the state. And right. Of course, as Fisheries Patrol, we were primarily saltwater and the commercial. Well, our authority was over salmon and food fish and shellfish, of course.
Okay.
And so we worked together quite a bit. In fact, Todd Vandervert and I worked together practically as partners for, my first 7 or 8 years of my career. So I learned a lot from Todd. I mean, he's brilliant. But yeah, so then the department merged, and that was, that was a time of some real turmoil, because being such similar agencies, there was kind of a sibling rivalry between the two,
Right.
And, of course, once we merged, then all the fish cops had to teach the game wardens, what an oyster looks like. And of course they just look at it and go, that's just a small gut pile,
Right. Yeah.
Then a bunch of them fled to the Eastern Washington where they didn't have to do that kind of work.
Right. Right. So prior to 94, like let's say during a busy season, so back when there were two agencies, fisheries,
yes.
And game, during a busy season of say salmon, would the game officers ever help you, or was it truly?
They did. Yeah, no, they did. They did. The timing was kind of wrong for that, because the peak salmon season is also all the hunting seasons. So, but when they could, sure. Yeah. Yep, they did. We worked together. There was, like I say, there was the rivalries. In some places it was really hot and they wouldn't talk to each other. Other places like here, we got along great. And, Todd could work fishery stuff as long as the sergeant didn't find out about it, that kind of thing.
Got it.
It's comical when you think back about it.
It was I'm sure it was mostly friendly,
Oh, yeah, friendly banter for sure.
And then sometimes people took it too far. So in 94, the two agencies merge and they become the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I assume you had two chains of command that had to be mixed, right?
Yeah. And that was, luckily I was still an officer at the time. So I wasn't in all that turmoil of, one chief trying to surpass the other chief and et cetera, et cetera. But it came together with a mixture of both in our administration.
And then basically what that meant was you had wildlife officers who were responsible for everything, whether it was commercial fishing, recreational fishing, salmon fishing, trout fishing, game hunting, all of it, right?
Correct. Yes.
And, just for listeners or people who are watching on YouTube, just picture the state of Washington. The entire west side, of course, has the Pacific Ocean on the coast. Right. And then what you can't forget ever is that there's a huge, Puget Sound is huge. Yes. And all the major cities, Seattle, Tacoma, Olympia, are on Puget Sound. So you have a huge recreational fishery there, a recreational shellfish habits practice. You have Native American issues from the Bolt decision. And then off the coast there, you have commercial fishing, which also involves salmon and other fish that.
Yeah. And there's commercial fishing, you know, in the sound in as the sound well.
Too.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then there's other conservation issues too, such as, you know, whales and seals and sea lions make their way into Puget Sound. Even killer whales are in there occasionally. So for me, one of the things that always struck me that was tough about Washington, working in Washington, was like, you know, obviously salmon, they move from salt water to freshwater, right? So you end up having, you end up having these two issues where you got a commercial fishery for salmon, then they, and then you got a recreational fishery, and then they move into the rivers and you have a totally different group of people that are targeting them for whatever, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then, boy, I don't even have it on my list to talk about Native American issues.
Washington is, as you know, so complex to be a fish and wildlife officer in Washington. I mean, your head just spins all the time when you get a call, and it's like, okay, it could, you know, what if it's a tribal person in his usual and accustomed area, you know, throwing a net in a river. So is that, you know, do they have the season open? Should I got to call the tribal police now and find out? And it's very complex, very complex.
Yeah. I would say working in Washington is probably right up there with working in Alaska, where there's really complicated native rights. You always have to keep in the back of your mind. It's like having a totally different rule book.
Right. And every tribe is, you know, is an individual government. So right. It's not, so when, you know, we're getting way off beat, but you sit down with a tribe and maybe like as a captain to try to work out some issue. And the very first thing that happens is, you know, their chairman of the tribe, basically the president of their nation.
Right.
Comes in and wants to know where's your director? You know, I don't want to talk to you. Why am I here at my level talking to somebody that's like four levels equivalent below?
Yeah, exactly. So you're not only do you have an enforcement role there when you're dealing with Native Americans that you have to sort out, that's different than when you're dealing with non-natives, but
right. You
almost have a geopolitical issue you have to deal
with. For sure. Yes.
Government relationships, right?
Huh?
Yeah, and it could be a big deal if a officer screws up the relationship with a tribe. That could really cause problems for the department.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And that's where good relationships with the tribal police are, you know, critical.
So important. And you know, I'll have to say that in the field, tribal officers and our officers, there is great. Where it gets more complicated is the more up the chain you get with, you know, policy and procedure and legal issues and all that.
Yeah. You know, that is so true across law enforcement. Just as one other aside, you know, while I was an agent, I obviously it's federal agents. We work with other federal agencies. And while I was overseas, I worked with foreign agencies and I had the same experience, you know, the relationship with the field people was always great. Like, you know, a field agent with Homeland Security or FBI. Great.
Right.
An officer with the Zimbabwean Forestry Department. Great. But further up the chain of command you go, there might start to be issues that where there's conflict, you know.
For sure.
In fact, you know, one time, speaking of tribal police, there's always been a very close relationship between tribal police agencies and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because, of course,
yes,
Department of Indian Affairs is under Department of Interior, just like Fish and Wildlife. But one time I was doing a ride along back when I was a lawyer before I was an agent, and I was with Matt Nixon, and we were making a traffic stop, and it was a carload of people. I don't know what they had been poaching, some type of shellfish. Matt was looking for backup over the radio, and the very first and only officers that showed up were tribal police officers. So
yeah.
Testament to the, you know, the relationship there. Hey, one more thing I was going to ask you about the structure. Eventually, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife added police to the end of their title.
Yes. Yes.
When did that happen?
Well, that would have come about I'll make a long story short, but so I'm trying to remember the year that that we had a bill passed that gave us general authority, made us general authority police officers. So the philosophy behind going from enforcement program on our patch to police was partly to represent that change in being fully general authority police officers, and then partly also it was Bruce Bjork was chief. It's come from the State Patrol, and his thought behind it was that because we work with so many different nationalities that are here, some don't speak English, but the police is very recognizable no matter what, you know, where you come from. If you see something that says police on it, you know, you're dealing with the, you know, with the law, with, you know, with a police officer. And so that was the theory behind that, to put the police on that, representing what we really are, and making it more easy for people to understand that.
That makes total sense. I hadn't thought of that. I figured it had something to do with authorities and jurisdiction issues, but not. Right. That's actually very kind of insightful, actually.
Yeah. It was taken by some to be stepping away from our responsibility as conservation law enforcement officers. You know, a lot of people had different opinions. When I say a lot of people, I mean inside our program, right, had a lot of different opinions about it. So you've probably heard, you know, people making fun of us thinking that we had to add police to our badge or whatever. But that was the reason. That's it.
And I never heard anybody mock it. And this leads into an excellent discussion I want to have with you about law enforcement authorities. But before we do that, I did want to have you explain, every state's organized a little differently. So you were an officer and then you became a sergeant. What does a sergeant do in the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife? Like, what's their, who do they supervise and what areas do they?
Right. Yeah. So the sergeant position is the best position that you could get. I wish I had ever went further than that. In hindsight, I was having so much fun as a sergeant. A sergeant has the supervision over a detachment, like a couple of counties maybe. So the way we're organized is we have six regions, and then within each of those regions, there's a number of detachments. Each detachment has, maybe as low as three officers, as much as seven or eight. Okay. And the sergeant is in charge of those and in charge of, you know, the field issues for that geographic area.
Got it. Okay. And then you became a captain. What is a captain's responsibility?
So the captain then is responsible for that, that entire region. So there's six captains, one for each region. And I was the captain in region six, stationed out of Montesano Well, I was captain for 13 years, and 10 of those were as a regional captain. And then I moved to headquarters, and long story short, I retired my commission at 30 years because I got in a horrible car accident off duty.
Right, right.
My neck, crushed my spinal cord. Mm-hmm. Have a limp now, and this and that, but long story. I'm glad to still be here.
we're all glad you're here, Dan. We're definitely.
Yeah, I wasn't able to continue on in the law enforcement role because of the physical requirements. So I did land a manager's position in the wildlife program, and spent the next 4 years there until I retired.
Right. Yep. No, we were. I wasn't going to bring up your accident, but we're all glad you're still here, Dan, definitely. After captain, though, in the department, it goes what, deputy chief?
Yeah, it goes deputy chief, and then chief.
And then chief. Yeah.
And
Okay.
now they've restructured since I retired, and I think they've well, we had lieutenants. That's true. So before I retired, yeah, you'd be
Oh, you
a
did have
you could
lieutenant.
so yeah, you could go sergeant, detective, or then lieutenant, and then captain and deputy chief.
Got it. Okay.
And I could be wrong now. I mean, they've changed the you know, when the Chief Bear came in, and Paul Golden, I don't know. Do you know Paul Golden is the deputy chief? Do you remember him?
No, I don't.
Okay, all right, good, great guy. But yeah, so they did some restructuring, and I think now they might have corporals or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It, you know, the back to now to the adding police to the moniker and authorities. You mentioned one of the reasons was to give wildlife officers in Washington general law enforcement authority. And this issue's always been interesting to me because, you know, in the prior to that, it was if you were enforcing the, if you're basically acting as a state wildlife officer, then you could enforce any other law.
Right.
And I remember there was always a conflict. Like, inevitably, there was some wildlife officer. This is before you guys changed to general authority back in the 90s when I was around. There was some officer who would see somebody driving recklessly or, you know, do something really grossly illegal, a traffic offense in front of them, and they'd pull them over.
Right.
And some supervisors at Department of Fish and Wildlife in Washington were like, great, good for you, right? Others were like, what the hell are you doing? That's not your job, right? And I think it always kind of shocked my conscience because the same exact thing happened in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when I got hired. Our law enforcement authority in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service comes from the Lacey Act. And the way the Lacey Act is written, it says officers of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have authority to enforce all laws of the United States while enforcing this act.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, oh boy, right? And some supervisors in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service viewed that as you couldn't enforce any aspect of Title 18, which is the general criminal code, unless you were actively in the process of, in that moment, enforcing the Lacey Act. Well, I thought that was crazy. And other supervisors viewed it as, well, we're always enforcing the Lacey Act everywhere we go.
Right.
You're always looking for a
Yeah.
Lacey Act violation, right? So it creates confusion, most importantly among supervisors, which I think is very dangerous because it doesn't give field personnel a clear understanding of what they are supposed to do, what they can do, what they're
Right. Yep.
expected to do, right? And my view on this, I want to see what your view is. As a civilian, I always took my mom as the example. What would my mom think, right? And you know, she does not law enforcement. She sees a marked vehicle, like a Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife marked game warden vehicle. There's a uniformed person in it carrying a gun with a silver badge on their chest. And some egregious reckless driving event happens in front of them and they don't do anything.
Right.
My mom would view that as dereliction of duty. She would expect a law enforcement officer to enforce the law. Or, you know, if you take it to its extreme, if you had a supervisor that didn't understand the law or wasn't willing to creatively like interpret it in a way that furthers public safety, you can imagine a scenario where there is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent out in public, armed, plain clothes, or there's a Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife officer out in public and views a violent crime or a more serious crime. And hesitates by asking themselves, do I have authority to intervene here?
Right.
And that's a bad situation, right?
Sure. Yeah. The general authority clears that all up.
Clears it up.
I've got an example. So prior to that, I think I was working with Greg Haugh, and we were patrolling, the shellfish beaches, come along on the highway, coming along, and here's this car parked off to the side with this obviously inebriated man, leaning up against the car, taking a leak, you know. And so I drive by, I go to the next driveway and pull in and sit and wait for him to get back in his car and pull him over. He's DUI. He goes to court. And the lawyer, sharp lawyer, he convinced the judge that I wasn't, it wasn't during doing my duty, because I stopped doing my shellfish patrol and pulled into that driveway and waited. And so therefore I was no longer being a fish cop.
Right.
And so my stop was illegal.
And did the judge buy it?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
man. That's
yeah.
That's crazy. Right there is the example why you need general authority.
Yep. They said if I would have pulled in behind him, then that would be one thing and contacted him then. But that's not how you make a DUI case when somebody's outside their vehicle.
Right.
So anyway, lessons learned there, but yeah.
No, it's a lesson that needs to be taken into seriously by any state that still has this issue, right? Or even federal agencies that might have this issue, because, you know, I was briefly a supervisor for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in L.A., and I always told my agents, you are always enforcing the Lacey Act on or off duty. You, because we had authority to carry when we were off duty. So yeah. You're always looking for a Lacey Act violation, period. Mm-hmm. And that's patrol. I mean, that's, we didn't do patrol work, but that's patrol work. You're always watching, you know, looking for a violation. And so you're always enforcing the act. And therefore, if you see a violation of Title 18, some, you know, criminal, don't hesitate to deal with it.
Sure.
But not every supervisor in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service felt that way. And I'm sure there's still some that don't view it that way. But right. To me, that is not a very creative way to go about supervising people or enforcing the law, because you are a public safety officer in the end, even if your job is primarily wildlife crime.
Yeah. Now, there's a fine line, too.
Yes.
Because a big difference between pulling over somebody that blew past you at 90 miles an hour or pulling somebody over because you notice their tabs are expired.
Yes. Right.
So, and officers, well, and supervisors need to, you know, really impress upon their staff that we are fish and wildlife first.
Yes.
And if you're, you know, if you're, oh, I, there, Rugged Justice, you remember that one?
Yes.
When we were on Rugged Justice.
Yes.
And one of the episodes, They were riding with an officer that was work, you know, you go to work a boat ramp as a fish and wildlife officer so that you can watch people come in and contact them and check their catch and all of that.
Right.
But this guy was driving around the parking lot looking for expired tabs that he could send a ticket to. Oh, and I'm like, well, that's just, yeah.
That's, but you know,
the way general authority should be for a conservation officer. General authority should be a tool to be yes. used in conjunction with their duties, but not something to stray away from their duties. And yes. So there's a fine line there.
No, and that's a good point. And for me, the way I would describe it would be, see if you agree with this, it would be that's a performance issue, right? Versus an authority sure. issue, right?
Right.
So no question, yep. the officer has authority to write that ticket, but yep. that's a performance issue that needs to be dealt with, because that officer's not focusing on the right things for their job, right? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that'd yeah. be like, you know, and yeah, it'd be, yeah, there's lots of examples. It'd be like a Secret Service agent focusing on something, a drug, you know, DEA stuff, you know.
Yeah. And
they can do it, but not really.
Yeah. There. But what the way it's supposed to happen is those things fall in your lap while you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many drug cases I was involved in, but that was because, you know, because I, you know, contact them and they have drugs on them or whatever, you know, or they have a warrant and so they go to jail, you know, that kind of stuff. But your primary focus is on protecting fish and wildlife.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you remember this or not, but Greg Haw used to be, he was an officer with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife who was on your Marine detachment when I knew yep. you, when, you know, when I was hanging out with you back then. he used to be able to look at somebody who he was approaching and he would say, I remember he'd go, we're going to find drugs in this guy's sock, or we're going to find drugs in this guy's underwear or whatever.
Right.
I was never with him when he wasn't right.
Oh yeah. He had the nose for finding something wrong. He had very good instinct on that. Absolutely.
He really did. And you know, one of the things I learned from you, you did too. You taught me something called the oh shit look. Can you explain the oh shit look?
Yeah, I guess that's when they first realize they're going to be contacted and they know that they've got something illegal on board or they're using illegal gear or whatever. And yeah, you get that deer in the headlight look. And yeah, when you recognize that, you know you're onto something.
Yep. I can't tell you how many times I was with you and you were like, oh, I just got the oh shit look. And 100% of the time when you told me we just got the oh shit look, you found violations on it.
Yeah.
Yep. Never failed. It's funny the skills you develop.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's you develop those and that. Yeah. I like to think that's what makes game wardens apart from some of our, you know, some of the other types of law enforcement you really have to develop the skill to be able to get where you need to go in an investigation. And a lot of it's instinct, but it's not really instinct. If it's worked for you time and time again, then
you know, it's one of those things that you don't really know how you develop the skill. It's almost like a subconscious skill.
You just
kind of know. And it's hard. You couldn't really articulate how you know. You just do. And it's built up over a series of many, many, many experiences that you probably don't even consciously register, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And interesting, too, you and I think, shared the same philosophy about officer discretion, which I think sometimes many people in law enforcement do not really understand officer discretion. It's kind of, I think, unique in free societies for sure. We officers, just a regular officer out there in the field, has a lot of discretion about when and how they enforce the law against people. And in some countries that might be viewed as corruption, right? But in the US it's not, because it's not like the officer's taking something in exchange for one behavior or another. But when you were a captain and when you were a sergeant, how did you view officer discretion in terms of how you wanted your people to operate? Did you want them to be black and white? You broke the law, you're getting cited. Or how did you view that whole thing?
Just the opposite of that. Okay. But discretion is one of your biggest responsibilities as a law enforcement officer, and you have to use it wisely, and you need to use it when, you know, I mean, there's a big difference between some guy and his son fishing and maybe he doesn't have a license, but he's casting for the kid and handing the rod and you know, so technically he's fishing. Well, use your discretion. I mean, he's given an orientation to his son about the great stuff that's available to do outdoors. And then you go in and ruin it for him because you need that ticket, you know. In fact, we had for a period of time, our chief was wanting us to have to put quotas on.
Never on good.
Yeah. Targets, I guess. Yeah. But so what happens then is somebody writes a ticket that they otherwise wouldn't have because they're worried that they're not going to write enough tickets. Mm-hmm. And I actually stood my ground as the captain and said, no, not in my region. We are not having quotas. And so I developed some weird mathematical thing on how I could evaluate their performance without using quotas as a ticket or as a measure.
Right.
And I was able to do that. But I was the only region in the state where the officers didn't have an actual quota.
Good for you. Good for you. Because I think, you know, there are intangible benefits sometimes to an officer making a decision in the field, right?
Oh, yeah.
And some of it comes down to that kind of unconscious experience that you've had, and you know what, who you have in front of you was a person who goofed up, right?
Yeah.
And they don't need to have their entire weekend and the experience with their children and their just impression of fishing or hunting to be ruined.
Right.
They're probably scared to death already that you contacted them, right?
Sure. Yep.
And then there are other people who are actively, they don't give a shit, and they're actively trying to break the law, and they're sneaking around, and they're looking for you when you come, and they lie to you when you
talk. Those are the ones you want. Yep. Those are the ones you want. I was going to say something very insightful and intelligent. Now I can't remember what it was.
Well, let me ask you this on that regard. How would you describe those intangible benefits? For example, I remember one time I was with you, and I think a guy was crabbing, and he was with his son, and they had too many crabs. And I remember you walked away, and you and I had a conversation, and you just were kind of educating me on what you're thinking. Right. And you said, hey, the guy's like two crabs over or whatever. He's here with his 10-year-old son. I don't want to ruin crab fishing for this kid. And this.
Yeah.
So you did not cite him.
Right.
What's the bigger benefit to, you know, some people might say, well, he was two crabs over. He needs a ticket. Why? What's the bigger benefit there?
Well, you're representing your agency, and you're trying to create or maintain a good image for the entire agency. So, you know, the old, he'll go and tell two people the story about how great, you know, how professional and great those two guys were when they contacted me.
Right.
And they'll tell two people the same story, and each of those will tell two, you know, and the story gets out. Same, unfortunately, with when a person, you know, if a person doesn't use discretion and they leave, you know, and they tell two people about the chicken shit ticket that they got, and the word spreads.
Yeah.
Now I will say, though, the version of the person who got cited and the reality of the contact are very two different versions. Almost always.
Yeah. Yes. Almost always. I teach criminal justice at Cal State. And sometimes my students will say things like, you know, how come, you know, one person doesn't get a traffic ticket from a LAPD officer and another person did the exact same traffic offense and they do get a ticket. And they kind of are talking about it as if it's a negative that officers have the discretion to make the call. But I think in a free society, we want officers to have a lot of discretion. We don't want them taking bribes. We don't want them giving favorites to people based on race or, you know, a pretty woman or whatever. But we want officers to be able to look at who they have in front of them and make a call.
The totality of the circumstances.
Yeah.
You got to weigh everything in and decide whether a citation is the way to educate the person or they can be, you know, it's a minor offense and you can educate them without the citation and maybe even have a better result.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, before we move on, did you remember the insightful thing you wanted to say?
Yeah, I think I was going to say, we didn't want, this is back on the discretion issue or on the quota issue. And that was, I never wanted an officer to feel like they had to write a ticket that they wouldn't otherwise have done just because they're trying to reach a number.
Exactly. I think that's a perfect place to end our discussion on discretion. I think that's what made you a great supervisor, Dan. One of the things, you know, in this show, you and I are having a very kind of broad ranging general discussion.
Sure. But
on this podcast, one of the things I try to focus on are bigger issues, bigger problems, areas where wildlife conservation law enforcement officers are involved in, you know, bigger picture issues, mostly wildlife trafficking and, you know, saving species versus animals, things like that. One of the things that Washington was into back when I was there in the 90s, I assume they still are because it's a huge issue, is shellfish enforcement.
Exactly.
And the reasons for their focus on shellfish enforcement, I think, will kind of surprise people. And before you explain it, I think most people would just assume it's a conservation issue, but it's not. And I just want to point out that, you know, people who are not familiar with the Pacific Northwest and Washington State in particular, you have to understand that the Puget Sound has over 2,500 miles of coastline. Just in, you know, that's the inside of the sound. So that's a huge area. And a lot of it is prime habitat for shellfish. And can you explain, like, why is Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife so interested in shellfish enforcement, and why is that so important?
Right. Yeah. And you're right. It's not a conservation issue. It's a human safety and health issue.
Why?
So here's the scenario, right? So the Department of Health and the U.S. FDA, their programs, ensure that the contaminated clams from pollution or sewer or whatever are, you know, restricted from being commercially harvested and sold into the market. And so we have areas that are closed for those reasons, like Dyes Inlet and up in Bremerton. It's gets all the runoff from the city streets. It has sewer outlets all over the place. During heavy rainfalls, their sewer systems sometimes fail and the overflow goes right in into the water, and it's prime habitat for like clams and oysters, particularly clams, Manila clams, steamers. And so those areas are closed, but they are absolutely rich in clams. I mean, you can literally go down and scrape your boot across the gravel and wow, flip a dozen Manila clams.
Wow.
Yeah, we called them Bremerton Browns because they were sewer. They were growing on sewer. You know, they were eating the stuff from the sewer outflow.
That's the crazy thing, right? Because these are filter feeders. And often in these beaches that are contaminated with raw sewage, they thrive, right? They love it.
Yeah.
But because they're filter feeders, they take all these contaminants into their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And because the area is closed to commercial harvesting, it's, like I say, it's just rich with shellfish. And shellfish, I mean, in those kind of areas, one person can dig 200 pounds of clams in that tide.
So what would be the incentive?
If they're a good poacher, yeah.
Yeah, what would be an incentive for somebody to go do that? What's somebody going to do with 200 pounds of clams that they dig?
Right.
There?
So the number of different ways they can camouflage it as a legitimate, say they're a rogue shellfish company. You know, we've got hundreds of very small shellfish companies. You know, just people that have one beach that, you know, get licensed and all of that. And so, so one mechanism is to use your shellfish tags, because every bag has to be tagged, with the date it was harvested and where it was harvested and all of that. And so if you could successfully get away with that night of poaching and take the clams, to your house or whatever and then tag them and then take them to the market. Yeah. Representing them as coming from a different beach. There's also just simply the black market, throw your clams in your trunk of your car and go, shopping around at restaurants that want to buy them or taverns. And then you have the whole tribal authority or tribal, issues. Where if you had a buddy that was a tribal member and willing to take your clams, you know, he'd go through and sell them as though it was off of a tribal dig. And so it's important to catch them in the act. Not that we haven't done huge investigations where we were able to put paper trails together and all of that, but ideally you catch them in the act. And it's usually at night. They're very crafty in how they get away with it. In fact, I always like to call the evolution of the clam poacher, the dirty clam poacher. That's the other things we call them, dirty clams.
Yeah. You know, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say it was really incredible to watch over the years, because when I first came on, there wasn't a lot of active enforcement in that. In fact, I think mine and Dwayne McAveeny's positions at the time were funded by Department of Health, and, you know, so that, you know, not that our duties were solely sanitary shellfish enforcement, but that the legislature had appropriated money for two officers to help with that issue.
Out of after Department of Health budget. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another example, performance issue, right? So you're a fully commissioned fish and wildlife officer, but your primary duty is to be focusing on these sanitary shellfish issues, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The way it works usually is you get approval for those positions, but everybody's supposed, you know,
yeah, everybody's
one person's designated for that work. Everybody shares in it.
Right. Everybody, it's probably, if it's high priority for the department, everybody's going to work on it. Right.
Right.
So it, just so people understand. So we're talking about commercial, this is the danger here is commercialization of these clams, yes. Right?
Yeah.
Which is so often the issue in all, you know, truly the bigger issue, wildlife conservation or wildlife cases, it's really commercialization that does damage one way or the other, either
right.
Populations or public health. What could happen if these clams get into our food chain? You know, they get into restaurants up in Seattle or Tacoma.
They could have a number of different, you know, health issues, paralytic shellfish poisoning, E. coli. I'm trying to remember the name of the algae that occurs. Anyway, there a number of things. You know, the virus that happens on sales vacation cruises.
Cruise ships. Yeah. Okay.
What is that? Neurovirus or whatever.
Yeah. Norovirus. Right.
Noro. There you go. Yeah. Just a number of things, and they can affect especially the elderly or immune, you know, people that are already have low immune system, and it can hospitalize people and it can cause death as well.
It can kill people. And you know, who'd have thought a fish and wildlife officer is out there involved in kind of a pretty critical public health issue, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe preventing death from people who eat contaminated shellfish at restaurants in Seattle. And that could be a tourist from Germany or
exactly
me or you. Right. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is just one of the more interesting things. And especially since the officer positions are funded by the Washington Department of Health, because there's an opportunity here, I think, at the federal level. Like there are wildlife trafficking presents public health issues, such as the introduction of bird flu into the United States. There are lots of birds trafficked around the world all the time, and a lot of them are trafficked in the passenger compartments of long-haul commercial airline flights. So somebody sitting next to you for 17 hours that has live birds strapped to their body.
Sure.
That came from the wild. Anyway, I think there's room at the federal level for some of these federal public health agencies to fund some law enforcement work to try to prevent the introduction of zoonotic diseases that could kill us. Right.
Yes. Right.
I think that's a very cool thing that the department does.
Yeah. I think, you know, just for accuracy.
Yeah.
Those positions initially were funded, for that purpose. But I don't think that the Department of Health actually funds us each year. I think that those ended up being into our budget. So we don't actively dip into Department of Health funds for those positions.
Okay. Did it start that way though?
You know, I'm not really sure if the funds were reduced from Department of Health funds that, you know, during that biennium or if it was, you know, funds created by the or allotted by the legislature for that purpose.
Yeah, maybe it was just the Washington Department of Health went to legislature and said, yeah, hey, we need this. Probably. That could be what happened. Yeah.
This is back in 1987. So
yeah. I
don't remember the details.
It's a program that's been around a while. But it's great because it illustrates how, you know, different agencies can complement each other's missions, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So we're coming on to the end of our time, Dan, but one of the things I wanted to ask you about, I don't know the details really. I'm sure you told me at one point years ago, but there was a time earlier in your career, I think you were a wildlife officer, where somebody pretty seriously assaulted you on the job. Do you recall the circumstances of that or what happened?
In fact, it was related to sanitary shellfish enforcement.
Well,
middle of the night, the winter, we were staking out a boat ramp in an area that's closed for commercial activity, and what the heck? Some car came in like really super fast and skidded down the ramp and turned around and went racing off, and we went after him. I think I was working with Steve DeMero. Remember him?
I do remember Steve. Yeah.
Yeah. And, somehow or another, I don't think we were able to catch up to him or whatever, but then we get a call from State Patrol saying that, there was a car in a ditch, you know, a few miles away from us, obviously those people. That they had walked to a small grocery store nearby, and they wanted somebody to contact them, hold them, for investigate them for that vehicle accident.
Right.
So we pull up and see, you know, see like, I don't know, three or four guys standing in the parking lot of this gas station. And as we pull up, one of them bails, runs across the highway. I just instinctually just jump out and run after him. He runs across the driveway or the highway, hits a barbed wire fence, flips right over it, and takes off running. Because I thought I'd just catch him at the fence, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But no, he just flips right over that thing, takes off running. So I crawl through the fence and take off running after him out through this pasture. And I'm saying, stop, police, stop, you're under arrest. And he keeps putting his hands towards his waistline.
Yep. And
keep your hands where I can see him. Stop. Keep your hands where I can see him. And at one point he trips and falls, which allowed me to come up. And I just kind of, just as he's getting up, I just slam into him with my full body weight not that he was about twice my size, but.
Now, Dan, you and I are about the same height.
Yeah,
we're not the tallest guys in the crowd. Yeah.
Yeah. And as I do that, I kind of roll past him. And so as I'm getting up, he's on me, yelling at me, screaming, and he tackles me. Mm-hmm. So I got this guy that's 270 pounds or whatever and 6 foot something. Now he's attacking me, mm-hmm. and he's got me wrapped, got my arms wrapped, mm-hmm. and down on the ground. And so, I used to wrestle, you know, in junior high and high school. And so I more just kind of went into a wrestling mode to get onto my stomach and then out from under him. And I get on top of him with a hair hold. And hair holds, you know, they don't teach that anymore, but that's one of the greatest way of controlling somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you grab a fistful of hair and squeeze as hard as you can.
Yeah.
And so I basically felt like I was on a bull, riding a bull, you know, and he's keeping trying to put his hands, you know, I'm like, show me your hands, get your hands out. You know, you're under arrest, put your hands out. And he starts yelling at me to kill him. Kill me. Just kill me. Kill me. I want to die. Kill me. And I'm like, oh boy, this is the real fight for life here.
Yeah.
And anyway, so goes on a little bit. It's wintertime. I had gloves on, right? It was okay for the hair hold, but I could not get, so I get my pepper spray out and I could get it to go. So I've got it right in front of his face and my gloves are restricting me from pushing the top down. But he finally recognizes that I'm trying to spray him. And at that point he goes, don't spray me, don't spray me, don't spray me. And he puts his hands out and I was able to arrest him. Well, he didn't have a weapon on him, but he had a pocket full of meth.
Yeah,
that's why he kept trying to reach in, because he's trying to get rid of it, you know.
And get rid of his meth.
Yeah. But you know,
crazy, because reaching, you know, just reaching for something that could be a weapon would be.
Oh, yeah.
There's a good chance the police officer could shoot you at that point.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was one of my biggest altercations in my career. I had one similar before I was a fish cop, but anyway, yeah, it was, and he was so high on meth that we had, he had, like a heart rate of like 185 or something. And so we took him to the hospital and stayed there with him, you know, and it was hours before his heart rate came down. And anyway, he ended up doing prison time. So we charged him with assault and police officer. Yeah. I think he did like 5 years or something.
Yeah, remember, he got a pretty good sentence for assaulting you. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are scary situations that can unfold so quickly because, like you said, you see somebody run. If you're a proactive, aggressive officer, you take off after them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then all of a sudden, pretty quickly, you find yourself alone in a field.
Find myself, you know, a couple hundred yards away. And of course, Steve DeMero, he's got three people. He's trying to deal with two. And he's looking back. You know,
exactly. Exactly.
Man, I didn't know what to do. I just.
And, you know, if you think about the situation, yes, Puget Sound is highly populated, but there are areas around the sound, particularly in areas where, you know, people are doing nefarious things at night that are pretty remote. And you were likely, it was a backup for you was a ways away, probably.
Been
Washington State Patrol would have been the closest. They wouldn't have gotten there.
Matt Nixon rolled in. He rolled in at just as I was coming out of the field with him.
You said Matt Nixon did?
Yeah.
It's really, I remember that story, you telling me that you'd been assaulted. And, you know, that's something that's very important to pay attention to if you're out there working alone. Is
for sure.
Because, you know, not only could he be reaching for a gun, but what people always have to remember is whenever an officer gets involved in an altercation, there's always a gun in the altercation. Yes. And it's your gun. It might be your gun. Yes. Right?
Yeah.
If he gets a hold of your gun, that's trouble.
It's, game over.
Game over. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I used to, people used to comment, like, you know, you're working with a Pierce County Sheriff's deputy or something, or having coffee with them or whatever. And, you know, they're seeing bad shit every day. Right. Yeah. And they would say, you guys are crazy for doing what you do. You know, I go, are you crazy for doing what you do? He goes, yeah, but I always have backup within 30 seconds or a minute, you know?
Yeah. That's exactly right. And, you know, we'll leave our listeners on this note. If you look at U.S. Department of Justice statistics, wildlife conservation officers are statistically much more likely to be assaulted in the field than any other law enforcement officer.
Yes, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. So a game warden in Washington State working Puget Sound is more likely to be assaulted in the line of duty than an LAPD officer working downtown Los Angeles. So
it's weird to think that, isn't it?
But it is. But it's sobering thought.
Yeah. 90% of the people we contact, you know, are just great people having, you know, taken advantage of the opportunity to harvest, some, you know, shellfish or wildlife. So,
right. Yeah. Right. And then adding on top of that, when you're out there looking at people who could be commercially poaching, right? They got money involved. They get money in the at stake. And that, I always say, you know, the things that make people really dangerous and when they think you're going to take their liberty away. So if they're about to be arrested, that could be a dangerous person. if you're going to go into their home, like on a search warrant, that's a dangerous person because sure. people protect their homes. Yep. And then the other thing is if you're about to take their money, their living, or putting that at jeopardy, that's something people will fight you for. So,
yep. And in our line of work, everybody we contact has either a gun, a knife, or both.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, Dan, listen, I can't tell you how much I've appreciated having this like really interesting, broad conversation with you. You're one of my all-time favorite law enforcement persons and people in general. I constantly, you know, while I was on the job, I always asked myself, what would Dan do?
And, well, I'm going to start just asking what Ed's mother would do now. So,
yeah, it was another good
rule.
What would mom think of this? Yeah, that's always a good rule to follow. Anyway, Dan, I appreciate you coming on the show. I hope to have you back sometime.
I'd love to be a regular. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think you'd be a great regular. But thank you so much. I appreciate your time. And we will see everybody next time.
All right, Ed. All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.